Thanks for joining us here on the Indiana Ag Policy Podcast. Eric Pfeiffer here from Hoosier Ag Today, and the podcast is presented by the Indiana Corn Growers Association and Indiana Soybean Alliance. We're here at apparently Hat Studio B. I saw the note out outside the door. Apparently this has now become, here at the Indiana Soybean Alliance headquarters, Hat Studio B, here at the offices. Thank you for that, Steve. Steve Howell here.
You know, it's great to have you here, and we thought I ought to make it official, so we took a sticky note, and with a ballpoint pen, we wrote out Hat Studio B. And
I don't think around here it gets any more official than that.
And when we kick you out, it'll be easy to just peel it off and throw it in the trash. So
it doesn't get any more official. So thanks for joining us, and today we really just wanted to run through, you know, in terms of politics, this week, it doesn't get any better. I mean, this is election week. And we had a lot of results come through, and this is kind of like the pinnacle of ag policy. We saw just a lot of things happen this week, and we're going to run through all of it, and we've got some great guests here to discuss it as well. First, we have John Ketzenberger here with the Nature Conservancy. John, you have been in this space for a long time. Give us a chance to learn a little bit about you. We had the opportunity to we've met many times here over the years, but we had the opportunity to work together at the Indiana Agri Institute, the Lieutenant Governor debate. Just introduce yourself here for us, John.
Sure. Well, first of all, thank you for having me on. I'm glad to be here with you, Eric, and with you too, Steve. And Chuck, I'm looking forward to hearing what we all have to say, because I sure don't know what I'm going to say. You mentioned my tenure, and my first session I covered. I'm a recovering reporter and editor for newspapers, and I had covered my first session in 1991 and been involved with it ever since, so that's a few years. And then worked at the Indiana Fiscal Policy Institute when the newspaper business went away, and was fortunate to work there and learn more about what's going on with state finance. And then after that, I got really lucky and hooked on with the Nature Conservancy to run their government relations effort in Indiana. So that's the short of it, and happy to talk more about it, about what the subject is instead of myself.
Recovering reporter. I'm still there. I haven't gotten to the recovering part yet, so we're we'll get there. And you mentioned Chuck. We do have another very special guest with us today by phone. And Steve, you were able to get us hooked up with him and get him to join us today. Go ahead and introduce him, Steve.
Well, you know, it's only fitting that the Indiana we have an Indiana farm kid join us for the Ag Policy Podcast here in Indiana on Hoosier Ag Today. Chuck Connor, many listeners will recognize that name. He's been in the ag policy space, I think, his entire career. I got to know him when he worked for Senator Lugar, and then I know he's worked on the Senate Ag Committee, was involved in a number of farm bills there on the Senate Ag Committee, did a stint at the White House with USDA, and I'll just actually just turn it over to Chuck to help fill in the gaps and tell us a little bit about maybe some more of his experience out in Washington, D.C., and his perspective as a farm kid from Indiana, but then also talk about the organization that he represents now. Chuck?
I appreciate that, Steve. You know, it's actually been 44 years ago this week that I got a call from Senator Richard Lugar in the middle of harvest, asking me to come to Washington, D.C. and help him write the farm bill. And, you know, I committed to do that for a couple of years. My dad and brother were already on the farm, and that seemed like a good time to do something else. And, you know, that 2-year commitment to Senator Richard Lugar, you know, turned into a very long-term career commitment. And I've been in this agricultural policy space for 44 years now. And, you know, I've worked for George Bush in the White House. I have served as the Deputy Secretary and Acting Secretary of Agriculture. But more recently as well, I have represented in Washington all the farmer-owned cooperatives across the country for the last 15 years. And I've, you know, really, really enjoyed that work, basically being a voice for farmer-owned companies across the country.
Well, Chuck, we appreciate you joining us today. We've got some interesting perspectives here on the podcast to really just kind of break down what we saw earlier this week. And it's really no surprise we are still awaiting some of those election results here as we speak on Friday morning on this Indiana Ag Policy podcast. Here in Indiana, though, the results are in, and we do have those results. Let's run through some of those now. Obviously, we know what's happened with the White House at this point. President Trump is now going to be president again, 45, and then again 47. So we have that figured out. We have Senator Mike Braun, now Governor-elect Mike Braun. Jim Banks has now moved from Congressman Banks to Senator-elect Banks. We have that figured out. And as far as representative seats in the House, we have that figured out as well across Indiana. And I think that there weren't any surprises across the state. And you guys can correct me if I'm wrong, but Republicans took those seats where we expected, except for the two seats that we anticipated were going to remain Democrat. In District 1, Frank Mervan, that was going to be a Democrat seat all along. Andre Carson in the 7th District, that was going to remain a Democrat seat. Districts 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 8, 9 were all going to remain Republican with Rudy Yochum. Marlon Stutzman returning to that seat vacated by Jim Banks. He was there before Banks was and is now back. Jim Baird, who serves on the House Ag Committee, he remains in that seat. Victoria Spartz, watching some of the election coverage on Indianapolis TV, that seemed to be a race somewhat early, but then ended up not being a race really at all. Jefferson Shreve in the 6th District, Mark Messmer in the 8th, and Erin Houchin retains her seat in the 9th. We do have a couple of new names in there. So let's just kind of break some things down here. Steve, where do we want to start here? Let's just kind of talk through what some of the takeaways were. I'll start with you, Steve. What were some of your takeaways from what happened on Tuesday?
I guess there were, in my opinion, not a whole lot of surprise. Perhaps maybe as a firm of win as it was for the Republicans may have been a surprise. We thought that a few of the races would be a little tighter. But actually going forward, we do have a lot of new faces. We've got we'll have a new governor, new senator, three new House members. So there's a lot to do there. But for as many new faces as we have, I think it's going to be an easy transition for our organizations, both the Indiana Corn Growers and the Indiana Soybean Alliance, because we've had relationships of some type with these folks in other positions. We, of course, worked with Governor-elect Braun as Senator Braun. Jim Banks, we worked with him in the House. Now he's going to be working in the Senate. Jefferson Shreve, I had the opportunity to work with him a little bit as he was on the Indianapolis County Council. So I've got a little bit of history there. I know some of his staff has already been announced. I've got some background with them. Mark Messmer served in the State House as a state senator. We've got some history there. So there's, I think, the introduction period, maybe, John, with your organization as well, that I think we'll be able to get up to speed to a working relationship pretty quickly with a lot of these folks.
What do you think, John? I mean, we're talking about, you know, what's going on here in the House. What does it look like for you and your organization?
The outlook is actually very similar. We've had experience with all of those folks. The only blankish spot, I suppose, for us is with Jefferson Shreve. We don't do much at the local level, so when he was on the City County Council, we just didn't have much interface with him. But when he ran for mayor, we got to know him a little bit too. I think that this group that has been elected is going to be good for natural Indiana, if you will. And I think that what we do and what Steve does and what ag does generally are you know, hand in glove. So I look forward to meeting the new folks and getting acquainted with them and their new roles. But I, You know, I see Representative Baird in the House continuing to play a key role, especially as we see what happens or doesn't happen with the Farm Bill in the next lame duck period and then going into next year. And I think that Senator Banks, Senator-elect Banks, is going to be an interesting person to see, because in the House is one of 435. He was, you know, pretty aggressive and got around, you know, the issues in a hurry. Now that he's in the upper chamber, as they say, mm-hmm. it'll be interesting to see how he navigates that. And I think he has a real opportunity with Senator Braun's movement to the governor's office. We need to have some representation in important areas in Congress and in the Senate. You know, former Senator Braun, Governor-elect Braun, had a strong record in ag, of course, but also with things like climate issues and conservation issues. And I think that as all of these pieces settle into their new roles, it'll be a real opportunity for all of us to extend reach of ag, but also how ag does its business so that it can conserve its most precious resource, the land that they use and the water that they need.
Here in Indiana, you know, and we'll touch on this. You know, the supermajority continues. The Republican party remains the hold in the governor's office, state house. It's going to remain. But you know, as we wait for things to unfold at the national level, it seems as though there's going to be kind of a Republican wave there as well. Chuck, let's bring you into this conversation here as we talk about these results in Indiana and how it's kind of taking the same shape here nationally. Let's talk about where this is moving with President Trump retaking the White House, with the Senate having already been flipped here, and maybe as things look right now, the House, the Republicans looking to retain control there. What does this mean for agriculture, in your opinion?
Well, unlike perhaps in the state of Indiana, where I think there was some sort of predicted outcomes there on a national scale, this election was full of a lot of surprises. And I think everyone expected the presidential race to be close. But if you would have told any of the pundits that Trump would win by this, you know, this wide of a margin, I think they would have thought you were crazy. So it was a very, very powerful day for the president elect. He had coattails, you know, and has carried control of the Senate now. Looks like there will be a 53-47 majority for Republicans at least, and there may be one other one still in play. Still unknown, but a very strong likelihood of winning the House for Republicans. And again, that was very unpredicted. It was almost certain that the House was going to go Democratic because of Trump's strength and his overwhelming victory. That has pulled a number of members of the House into the victory column. So now, you know, you've got a potential where Republicans have all three bodies of the legislative body. And that's pretty unusual during these kind of times where we have been sort of a 50-50 divided country for one party to have that kind of control. I think the implications are going to be pretty dramatic. Let me just say, winners and losers, if you will. Certainly, we watch tax legislation very, very closely as farmer-owned cooperatives, and I think farmers in general. Extending, you know, our current tax policy, which is, you know, pretty favorable policy, both for estates, for farms, for LLCs, corporations, pretty favorable. With Trump and now control of the House and the Senate being in Republicans, it's almost certain that those tax provisions that all expire next year are going to get extended. And I think generally most people would say that's pretty good news, you know, for American agriculture and for agribusiness out there. Regulatory issues. You know, my phone rings off the hook every day from people complaining about, you know, regulatory overreach, whether that's Environmental Protection Agency, you know, Department of Labor. It's just, you know, seems like there's a constant onslaught. I think you can safely say that when Trump takes office, regulatory overreach is going to stop. period. And we're going to have, you know, a lot of changes there in those regulatory agencies on our farms and how they interact with farms. Now, maybe on the more challenging side is, you know, we do have labor issues on our farms and ranches across the country. We've been working on that for a very, very long time, unsuccessfully. I think our chances of solving some of those labor problems in a Republican-controlled body gets a little bit more challenging, because it does interact with all of our border control issues and the like. And that's just going to be a lot stickier probably with the Republicans in charge than had it, you know, had it been a different set of circumstances. So, you know, all in all, there's mixture there. But I think generally, from what I hear from farmers in terms of tax and regulatory stuff, they're going to be very, very happy. Farm bill, I think, is still a complete unknown at this point. We just don't know the implications of the election yet on the farm bill. I would like to still see them try and get the farm bill done in this lame duck session that we're getting ready to enter into next week. You know, that lame duck session, just as a reminder, we'll still have Democrats in charge of the Senate. But I still think there's enough common ground here that we could get that done before, you know, Trump is even inaugurated as the next president of the United States. I would like to see that, get that out of the way. There's no reason we can't come up with agreements here to get a good farm bill done. But it's unclear whether that's possible, because obviously all the winners, you know, would like to wait and see, you know, what happens once they're in charge. But in my view, I think we ought to go ahead and get this farm bill done now. And there's really little reason why we shouldn't be able to do that.
Do you think, Chuck, that some of the election results here have given some of the Democrats that are in charge right now in the Senate, namely, you know, Debbie Stabenow, who did not seek re-election and has talked about this farm bill being her legacy, does she back off on some of those demands now and say, yeah, let's get this thing done?
Well, I've worked with Senator Stabenow for many, many years, and she does look at farm legislation as really sort of her major accomplishment of many, many years in the Senate. So I just can't believe she would not like to finish this up before she leaves office. And, you know, that's an important consideration here. She is chairman of the committee today. We, you know, we've talked about change. That change doesn't occur until, you know, January 20th, 22nd of next year. So she's still in charge. I'm hoping that she will press to try and get this done and really wrap it up, and so that this can continue to be a part of her legacy as she exits office and, you know, goes back to living in the state of Michigan again.
Yeah, I think you're right about the incentives for the Democrats, Chuck, because I don't think they get any better when the control flips. I think any leverage that they want to try to exercise and any input they want to have to the process, I think this is the time for the Democrats to make that move. It'll be interesting to see, you know, what happens over in the House and what the Speaker chooses to do and how the speaker approaches this, and see if there is a thaw on either side. I'm not sure what his incentives are versus hers.
Yeah, you know, my advice to the speaker would be, you know, when you look at the election results here, you know, rural America did come forward in a pretty resounding way for Republicans. And, you know, this would be a great way to sort of kick things off. And not that the farm bill are the only issues out there in rural America. I would not make that claim at all. But it's a very important issue out there in rural America. And I would advise the speaker to really deliver on this early, get it done, get it off the table, because I do believe that Republicans early next year in this so-called first 100 days, which is always, you know, the time that they say you've really got to get your work done, because after 100 days, it's back to kind of gridlock. So in that first 100 days, they have really been challenged, I think, by the voters who put them in office to focus on economic issues and the state of the economy. And that's why Donald Trump will be our next president versus Kamala Harris, was he convinced people that he can fix, you know, these problems in our economy. They've got to do that in the next 100 days. A farm bill probably should not be taking up time in that. Get it done now. Deliver that for rural America who puts you in office, And then in that first 100 days, really focus on those core economic issues that put put you in office.
Chuck, you talked about labor, and I know you and I have had these discussions for several years now. And this is an issue that, you know, you've talked about. There was a bipartisan effort that was on the table that just couldn't get put through because we haven't been able to separate this issue of ag labor and needing the workforce and the border. Is that what's going to hold up this whole issue again here, and why you think that there's going to be an issue with the Republican control and trying to figure out the ag workforce?
Yeah, I think it's going to be a sticky issue, as I've noted already. You know, it's one of those where the results of the election probably don't increase our chances of fixing this problem, certainly. But I think, as I look at it, there is no question, you know, one of the core issues that voters went to the polls on this time was on, you know, securing the border. And, there's going to have to be legislation to do that. You know, Trump will use his own authority to do a lot of that as well. Once we, you know, can truly say that we feel like the border is far more secure than what it is today, I think that does open up the possibility for us to have a bipartisan discussion of ag, labor, and immigration needs. And I think, you know, we've got a lot of Republicans, as I survey the Senate and the House, willing to step up and say, you know, this is not a border issue. You know, this is not about voting rights or anything of the sort. This is about food security and food production in this country. And we do need, you know, to solve this labor problem in order to continue to have the benefits of being a very, very well-fed society.
Chuck, getting back to the farm bill and the chances of getting it done in a lame duck, that's very encouraging. A little backstory there. I think Eric and I have a tenderloin sandwich riding on whether it gets passed this year or next.
Who's on which side?
I guess I'm just a glass half empty kind of guy. I just don't know that it's going to get done.
So Steve's the optimist here?
Steve is the optimist. Wow. Yeah.
And I guess that's good that we're, you know, maybe we got a little more leverage here to get this. So that's encouraging to hear from you, Chuck. I think my intel tells me that I think every farm bill stakeholder would prefer getting it done now as opposed to kicking it, because you're right. It won't take up any time first part of the next session, so we'd be looking at moving it into the summer. And on the farm, as you know, we need that certainty from the farm bill. But I guess as a Washington operative, you need. You know, we will kind of really start over because we, the committee makeups are going to be different. That the House version will have to go back through the House committee again, even if you change nothing in the language, and then it'll score differently. So the budget impacts of the current language would score differently. So I guess I'm encouraged that, you know, we maybe have a little more leverage to get things done, because what I'm hearing from the other ag groups and other farm bill stakeholders is, you know, we got to get this done. So hopefully we can, you know, kind of come together. And I think all regions of the country want to get this done.
Yeah, and I will point out what you guys already know, but the farm bill is also the largest source of funding for conservation across the country. Yes. Conservation title in the farm bill allows us to work with farmers to do so many things through the USDA and the NRCS and to improve farming practices so that you have more productivity and less runoff and, you know, the problems that are associated with those kinds of things. So it's a very important, you know, I'm optimistic now based on Chuck's analysis as well. He's raised my spirits a little bit, and, you know, I'm hoping that the speaker and Senator Stabenow are able to find a way to make it happen this lame duck session.
And let me say, in my defense, I didn't think that the election would turn out necessarily this way either. I don't disagree with what Chuck's saying here. I think that there might be the leverage there for Senator Stabenow to maybe start moving this thing through. I mean, there is. there is the incentive now to start moving this thing along. I don't think it was there before. I think it might be there now. That if we want to start having some serious conversations about this, maybe now they've begun. I don't know that they were there before. Maybe now it's there. Chuck, as we start to talk about, you know, what might happen next, we've seen you know, a lot of names floated about potential cabinet positions and Trump appointees. I guess the first question is, can we knock your name off the list for USDA secretary? You haven't been approached yet, right?
No, I have not.
Okay.
And, you know, I feel like in many ways I've had that time. I had the great pleasure of, you know, representing agriculture for several years as a deputy secretary. And I served almost 7 or 8 months as the acting secretary of agriculture. And, you know, that's quite a feat, quite an opportunity. And, you know, I feel like I've had my shot at that. And, want to, you know, really just be there to support whoever the next Secretary of Agriculture is. And on those along those lines, let me just say, you know, it's my hope and my organization will be, you know, working hard to make sure that the next Secretary of Agriculture, though, is someone who really, really understands, you know, what's going on out there in real world agriculture, if you will, not sort of any fringe elements, not other things, but, you know, real world farming out there in you know, in Indiana and places like that. It's important to have a secretary who understands that, always has been. Nothing, you know, that happened Tuesday night changes the fact that we really need a good hands-on type person to be the next Secretary of Agriculture.
We are hearing a couple of Indiana names being floated in that conversation. I'd be curious if you've been hearing some other names out there in D.C. One name being Ted McKinney, who was previous USDA undersecretary. Another being Kip Thom, Kosciuszko County farmer, was ambassador to the U.N. for food and agriculture. Are you hearing other names out there?
Well, there are, you know, as you might expect, sort of the day after the election, the speculation starts on all the cabinet positions, and there's a lot of names being kicked around. Some of those sort of fit the criteria that I mentioned, including my good friend Ted McKinney and also my good friend Kip Thom. You know, they are both agriculturalists, you know, right to their core, and would be do a great job in those positions. Other names, you know, that are being kicked around, maybe not so much at this point, but again, I think when the ag community bands together and my organization works with the like of Farm Bureau and others out there, as we, you know, I don't want to say demand, that's the wrong term, but as we really strongly encourage the Trump administration to look at someone in that position that really has the heart of a farmer, that's going to be real critical to us going forward.
As we look at some of the appointments to committees, we talked about, you know, some of the new faces here in Indiana. Of course, you know, we have representation on the House Ag Committee with Jim Baird. And I think we all agree that that's a great thing for Indiana, one of the I states, to be represented on that committee. And Jim is a great representative on that committee for Indiana with his background. Mike Braun was on the Senate Ag Committee, and with him now governor-elect. What do we think, guys? Are we hopeful that – I mean, I don't know that now Indiana, you know, I guess he was before Senior Senator Todd Young. I don't believe he'll be moving over to the Senate Ag Committee. I don't think that's really in his wheelhouse necessarily, his area. He's already on a number of other committees that I think he's remaining in. But do we foresee Jim Banks moving into that area?
Well, that's something that I would certainly like to see, primarily that Indiana needs a seat on that Ag Committee. Chuck would probably know better than I would, but I know that Indiana's had an Indiana senator on that on the Ag Committee since Richard Lugar was first sworn in. And Chuck, you might have some more background on how far back we've had somebody on there, but we've got to have a seat at that table for Indiana agriculture. And actually something that a lot of folks may not think about is we need that Midwestern voice on that committee. We're all Aggies. We all work together well. But we do fight like brothers at times where, you know, we'll have a disagreement, and we want that Midwest voice. It was good to have Debbie Stabenow from Michigan as the Ag Chair, just simply because she had that Midwest perspective that we need here in Indiana. So I'd love to see Jim Banks on that Ag Committee. Chuck, any thoughts kind of how those maybe you could explain real quick how you don't just pick a committee, you've got to be assigned that committee by leadership.
You do. You get a chance to sort of give your preferences and you rank them in order. And typically a new member will always sort of get their first choice. But, depending upon availability of seats on the various committees, sometimes that second choice gets a little dicey. I will just say I would strongly encourage Senator Banks to consider a seat on the Agriculture Committee going forward. There is a rich history there of Indiana and the Senate Ag Committee with my former boss, Senator Richard Lugar, serving many, many years as chairman of that committee. And let me just say that committee has such broad jurisdiction. You know, all of the Department of Agriculture and all that that implies, and people don't realize, you know, we think about farm programs, but all of our nutrition assistance, school lunch, federal housing, you know, so much of our rural housing are programs under the jurisdiction of that committee and the Department of Agriculture. I mean, commodity futures trading, all of our futures trading, not only on ag commodities, but energy and everything else, all flows through that committee. Probably the broadest jurisdiction of any committee in Congress. And I just, you know, I see the opportunity there to really establish yourself as a new senator occurring on that committee. And I would encourage him to consider that and continue that rich Indiana tradition.
You know, Chuck, it's interesting, too, because I think Senator-elect Banks's history and experience suggests that his interests when it comes to governing in the Senate probably are very similar to Senator Young's, the security mm-hmm. aspect, the military, foreign affairs, that kind of thing. But as Senator Lugar made so clear all those years ago when you were working with him, agriculture and food production is a security issue, and that really could be something that Senator-elect Banks brings to the committee in addition to all of the other wonderful things that you were talking about earlier.
Yeah, there's no question. And again, given the times that we're in internationally where there is so much instability across the globe, you know, food and these security issues are completely linked. And much like, you know, my former boss, Senator Richard Lugar, you know, at the same time he was chairman of the Agriculture Committee, I would say that he was probably the key leader in the Senate on foreign policy.
Absolutely.
And that, you know, it you're not stovepiped here. You certainly can have many, many diverse interests in that link between foreign policy, national security, and food and farm policy, I think is a terrific link and will be so relevant going forward these next few years.
Chuck, with the Ag Committee, we've always said that it's the most bipartisan committee out there in D.C. Here in recent years, has it become less so? Is it becoming more partisan? Is it becoming more like the other committees? Is it? I'm just curious because it seems like with this farm bill and with other issues, it seems like it might be, but it could also be some of the media, and I don't know, maybe I'm playing into this too. I don't know that it's necessarily ag media. It could be just other things on some other issues that are making it seem that way. You're there. You're seeing it. You're with these players that are in it. What is the sense there?
Oh, there is no question. You know, in my 44 years of working on these issues, and let me just say, this is the ninth farm bill that I have worked on. So I've got a lot of background here, and there is no question. It's undeniable that the House and Senate Agriculture Committees are more partisan today than what they have been in the past. Maybe a little slower coming than what, you know, has occurred on other committees, but squarely, you know, today, those committees are far more partisan than what they were in an earlier era. And that, you know, is reflected in the fact that, you know, we're now 2 years late in getting the farm bill done. I've been really frustrated because historically, you know, if you look at all the prior farm bills that I've been involved in, this farm bill, the differences are much narrower than what they have been historically. You know, this should have been the world's easiest farm bill to pass, but it's not. It's, you know, it's 2 years overdue, and that is only because of the partisanship and the inability of the House and Senate Agriculture Committees, Democrats and Republicans on each committee being unable to work together, pure and simple.
It's really unfortunate. I mean, I guess it's the world we live in now. It's just what Washington, D.C. has turned into and what the political world that we live in now has turned into. It's just a different place we're in.
It is. And I think if you asked most members of those committees, you know, do they like that? Most of them would say no, they don't. They wish it was different. They would like to try and make it different. But, you know, I look at this most recent election this week. I mean, so many contested races turned on, you know, representatives in those rural areas. And so, you know, that partisanship of control of Congress and everything sort of pointing, you know, on those narrow differences really gets focused on rural America, and the farm bill gets drug into that because of its, you know, impact on rural America. And it just makes it far more difficult when you have outcome of elections and control of Congress turning on these issues.
Let's take a time out here on the Indiana Ag Policy Podcast. And when we come out, we do want to dig more into some of the statewide issues, and some of the statewide election results and what's happening here in Indiana. We'll come back with more from Chuck Connor, John Ketzenberger, and Steve Howell here on the Indiana Ag Policy Podcast, brought to you by the Indiana Corn Growers Association, the Indiana Soybean Alliance.
Also made possible by Beck's Hybrids and Indiana Farm Bureau. There is strength in numbers. That's why the Indiana Soybean Alliance membership and policy and Indiana Corn Growers Association need you. These organizations represent Indiana soybean and corn farmers on critical and regulatory issues affecting their industry. Along with support from the national organizations, National Corn Growers Association and American Soybean Association, the Indiana members help determine public policy positions on critical issues, including farm bills, trade policy, and ethanol and biodiesel legislation. Become a member of Indiana Soybean Alliance membership, Indiana Corn Growers Association, or both. Visit incornandsoy.org to select a membership. That's incornandsoy.org.
At Beck's, we stand up for the things that matter most: our faith, our independence, and helping farmers succeed. As the largest family-owned seed company in the U.S., we believe in the integrity of remaining an independent family-owned seed company. Since our founding in 1937, we have continued to produce quality products backed by a quality family of employees and dealers dedicated to serving American farmers. And that's something to be proud of. Beck's, founded in faith, forged in America. For more information, visit beckshybrids.com.
At Indiana Farm Bureau, we serve tree farmers, goat farmers, and in fact, all farmers. With over 250,000 members, Indiana Farm Bureau represents a broad range of farmers and puts power in your collective voice. You also get advice from our subject matter experts, more affordable health plan options, and support for youth programs statewide. So whether you grow soybeans or strawberries, membership means you'll be heard. Become a member today at infb.org.
We're back. back here on the Indiana Ag Policy Podcast. Eric Pfeiffer here from Hoosier Ag today with John Ketzenberger, Chuck Connor, and Steve Howell. And we're talking politics at the national level. We're talking politics at the state level. A lot happening this week. It's been an interesting week. That's one way of putting it. Let's talk a little bit more here at the national level before we jump into things here at the state level. Chuck, there's a lot that has to happen here. We've touched on the farm bill and what we hope happens during this lame duck session, but there's a lot that Congress has to get done during this lame duck session. Let's talk through it. What has to get done here?
Yeah, you know, lame duck sessions, when you have a big change in, you know, control of Congress and the White House, like we have seen in this election, typically lame duck sessions, you would say absolutely nothing is going to happen because, you know, you're going to wait until the new team is in place. But that's not the case this time around, because Congress has passed a funding bill for the federal government that expires right before the Christmas holiday. And so they have to act on basically a massive funding piece that funds the entire federal government between now and Christmas. So doing nothing in a lame duck is really not an option for them. They've got to legislate in a very, very major way, as you can imagine, the entire government funding sort of pending out there. And again, just to reiterate a point, that's what gives me a little hope that perhaps in that legislative arena where they've got to do these things, we might be able to sneak in there and be a part of a farm bill package going forward.
I mean, that's what the government does. They only fund it for, 3 months at a time? I mean, that's just kind of how it goes now, right?
Well, they only fund it for a few months at a time, and, you know, they do it as one giant package. And, you know, there's 12 appropriation committees out there that, you know, that make up, you know, all the funding for the government. And it's been many, many years since those 12 committees have done anything. We typically just now fund the government with one massive giant package, literally thousands of pages of legislative text. Frankly, no one inside or outside of government has read the entire text of any of that. And it's not a very good way, you know, for prudent government to operate, but it's been our world for the last several years.
So maybe we get some things done here since they're already working anyway. We get some stuff done. There's some hope. There's some hope. Let's jump into and I guess, you know, Chuck, you know, since we're talking about, you know, typically the case would be not much to do because, you know, there's this whole transition. But, you know, talk about the transition. There is a lot of transition that has to happen before everything goes on. There's a transition that's going to be happening at the White House. There's a transition that's going to be happening at USDA. There's a transition that's going to be happening there on Capitol Hill. You've been a part of a lot of those transitions, I imagine. Just talk about how all of those transitions happen. What are some of the difficulties through those? I mean, are they always, they can't all be smooth, right?
Well, they're never, you know, very smooth, because obviously you're talking about, you know, leadership of government agencies and, you know, Congress, I mean, a massive turnover in members. And, you know, remember, each member has a very, very large staff. Typically, you know, if there's a change, you know, a good example in Indiana, I mean, you know, Banks' staff will be very, very different than Braun's staff, even though that's the same party. You can imagine that, you know, the differences that would occur if there's a change in parties in those circumstances. So transitions are messy. Let me just say this. My observation, having been, you know, worked in a lot of transitions in the past, the Trump administration in 2016 was a little unprepared for that transition, and they were sort of winging it, if you will, going forward. My strong sense is they anticipated winning this time. Again, probably not by the margin they did, but they anticipated winning, and they have a plan, you know, ready to sort of be laid down, if you will, in January when they take office. And I expect it to be a much smoother transition where we will, you know, know a lot of the political appointees that are going to be in place very, very quickly. Obviously, the Trump administration is going to have great benefit because the Senate is in Republican hands, and therefore all of Trump's political appointees that require Senate confirmation are very likely to get confirmed. Had it been, you know, the Democrats in charge of the Senate, very few would have gotten confirmed. So, you know, they have that benefit, and that will, you know, create, again, a smoother transition here in January as we move into that period. But I say smooth, it's always still choppy because it's just a lot of change.
I'm going back to I watched The West Wing many years ago, and you know, locked drawers and desks and everything else just to, you know, be mean during the transition. But it's a transition. There are always things to go through.
Well, let me just say on that, there's a little of that. In this case, I will just tell you. I know Secretary Tom Vilsack, you know, really, really well. He's a really, really good man. And I know for a fact that as he's, you know, preparing for this transition, his mandate to every single one of his people serving within the Department of Agriculture is you will cooperate and make this as smooth a transition as we possibly can. And I just know that's going to happen, certainly in our space, maybe not in every space, but I'm not worried about that in ag at all.
He's got to be up there for one of the longest serving USDA secretaries.
Like, he is the longest serving. Yes.
Yeah. I mean, it's, mm-hmm. he's been at it for a while.
A long time.
Yeah. So let's, speaking of transition, that's called a segue, Steve. That's a radio term there. We, segue into, state stuff here. We take, Senator Braun, now Governor-elect Braun, as he makes his way, from DC to Indianapolis, and, not much is changing in Indianapolis in the way of, you know, how things will be structured at the state house. Again, Republicans keep the supermajority. Not a whole lot is changing there, but things are going to be changing there in the governor's office and the lieutenant governor's office with Governor Braun taking over in that governor's office. And, you know, let's be honest, the style is going to be a little bit different. Governor Holcomb and Governor-elect Braun, two different people going about things different ways.
Yeah.
So what does this transition look like? What do you guys think, Steve, John?
Well, I'll just say what I know for sure is it'll be different.
Yeah. That's true. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, each governor is going to have a different style. I mean, we remember Governor Mitch Daniels was very kind of leaned into all the work, worked very closely with key legislators to get his priorities moving. He did the give and take with the legislature. Mike Pence was more hands off. Let the legislators do their work without a whole lot of as much involvement. I would say that Governor Holcomb has kind of been a mix of the two. Maybe on some issues really worked with them, and other times just stepped back and let them do their work. So, and then that's going to depend on the makeup of the legislature itself. If they're very, you know, if they got very strong leadership, it's a little more difficult for a governor to inject themselves. But I think given Senator Braun's personality, given his background as a business leader, build a business, I think you'll see him maybe a little more engaged than Governor Holcomb. But yeah, it's just going to be a different style. John has been around for a number of these shifts, and yeah, maybe he's got a perspective.
Maybe he does. But I will start by stipulating that I agree with your observations about, you know, the governor-elect's approach. and how it contrasts with our other governors of recent vintage. You know, I think it was interesting that when Governor-elect Braun announced his transition team, many of them were in the Daniels administration, some form or another. And I think that may be a sign that he's looking to maybe operate in that vein, where I think he will be more hands-on with the legislature. I think he will try to work with the leadership, the Speaker Todd Houston and the President Pro Tem Rod Bray. I think that he sees an opportunity in the fact that you have a supermajority in the legislature. The challenge, of course, is when you have so many members like that, you get a lot of ideas that maybe don't jibe with some of the other ideas that are out there. You don't have as much discipline, if you will, in the caucus. But I think you'll see a pretty comprehensive policy package from this administration. I know they've been working with, HOPE. I can't think of the acronym for that now, but it's a 501c4 that one of the former senators' staffers was working on his policy agenda and has been for months. And so I think you'll see a comprehensive package. I think ag will be an incredibly important part of this. And it'll be interesting to see, what the appointments to key agencies, such as the Indiana Department of Ag, what they will be, whether the current director, Don Lamb, stays, or if he leaves and somebody takes his place. It'll be interesting to see that transition and how that plays out going forward. But I do think that this is seen by the administration coming in as an opportunity to, kind of recast their relationship with the legislature and recognize the opportunity that they have and see where it goes.
I did hear that the leadership in the House and Senate, it is staying the same this year, so that is going to remain the case. And we heard from then just Lieutenant Governor candidate Micah Beckwith that their hope is to retain Indiana State Department of Ag Director Don Lamb. So if all that holds true, we'll see how that goes. But that was his plan at the time. So we'll see what happens there. We mentioned Senator Braun was on the Senate Ag Committee. He has an ag background. And, he has been pretty friendly to the industry. I think he's been friendly with organizations, Indiana Corn and Soy, Farm Bureau. It's been a good relationship with the ag industry over his time in the political realm here. So I assume that, we're all good. We're good here, right?
Well, I want to just inject a little bit in addition to what you just said, because Senator Braun, now Governor-elect Braun, has been heavily involved in conservation as well. You mentioned his ag land, but he also owns large tracts of forest in southern Indiana. My organization, the Nature Conservancy, has worked with him to, develop management plans and implement some regenerative ag practices on his land. So his interest is broad, and I'm happy to say that I think it's expansive as well.
Yeah, I think I'm trying to remember exactly what it was, but he was a leader of the Republican conservative
It was a Climate Solutions Caucus, a bipartisan group that he started with Senator Coons out of Delaware. And, they gained some traction and tried to do some real work. A lot of it got derailed by some of the politics of the day. But, I think the one thing that you have to say about the governor-elect is that he does have a broad set of interests. And I think he'll take on a lot of information, and we'll see where he goes and what he does with that.
Yeah, and I'm encouraged with, again, it's, as you mentioned, Eric, is his work on the Ag Committee, our work alongside with him in those efforts. We know that he's got a very strong interest in agriculture. So I see a lot of opportunities that can develop and some good work that can be done, not just with the Department of Agriculture, but agriculture is pretty much touched by all the agencies that we have here in the state. One effort that we'd like to see more of is agriculture being at the table, having a stronger seat at the table on economic development discussions and looking at opportunities within agriculture. How can we further develop our ag industry here to benefit farmers? We see an opportunity for additional industrial biotech development, bringing some of that those opportunities here to Indiana. We see a real opportunity in intermodal. How do we manage the containers that we have moving around the state to get those leaving Indiana full of corn and soybeans? That's what we'd like to see. So we're encouraged with his background, and we're going to be right there working alongside him to get things done.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting observation, Steve. And one of the things that we heard, Eric, at the debate in August at the state fair was from the lieutenant governor-elect, was that economic development is an area that they were going to look very hard at. Mm-hmm. And I do think that more expansive view of what economic development is and what it means and how it's intertwined, it's not... I think one of the biggest developments over the last 15 years of leadership in Indiana has been the movement toward regional development commissions, the economic development areas, and the implications that has for how communities approach this, so that it becomes less try to pick off each other's backyards and recruit more holistically in the state. And I think that's going to get a boost, and I do think it will be a more expansive view, because economic development is not just cutting ribbons at auto plants. It's many, many, many things, and it's going to be important for rural Indiana to be able to leverage that economic development as well.
And I'll tell you, I know that they've been doing some tremendous work at the Indiana State Department of Agriculture to leverage that and how agriculture plays into that. I know that they put together a regional development plan within ISDA. They started that under Bruce Kettler when he was there, and I know that they've continued that under Don Lamb. It's really great. So I know that they've been doing a lot of great work there at ISDA to really bring that into the fore there. So a lot of good things happening for agriculture, and we'll see how all of that continues as we wrap up today's Indiana Ag Policy Podcast. Chuck, before we let you go, just want to give you an opportunity again to talk about the organization you represent and what you're doing out there in D.C. to help farmers and cooperatives.
Well, I represent the National Council of Farmer Cooperatives, and that's really all your farmer-run businesses across the country, all of your ag retailers. The likes of Land O'Lakes and, a lot of different marketing companies out there that really sort of, the goal here is to give farmers control and the opportunity to have business interest beyond just, the growing of the grain and the raising of the livestock. And, that's always a good thing. I'm honored to have represented them for many, many years. We really look forward to the couple of years ahead. We've got important tax legislation that expires next year. The election, I think, is going to make getting a good tax policy probably a little bit easier for us going forward. So we look forward to working with this new Congress and President-elect Trump and seeing that happen. As I've said, I think there's an opportunity here on the farm bill. We just got to get this farm bill done. Farmers need that certainty out there. There's no excuse. Farmers really need to demand, passage of this bill immediately. There is no reason why it shouldn't be done. Our differences are very, very small by historical standards. Just tell them to get it done. And that's got to be a core message coming from rural America out there. So I look forward to continuing to work with you guys and representing those interests of Midwest agriculture. We've had a blessed year this year. There's been challenges, but overall it's been a pretty good year in agriculture. We're thankful for that. Thankful for this holiday season that's coming upon us. And again, thanks for this opportunity.
Hey, Chuck, real quick, those tax policies that you talk about, we brought this up a podcast or two ago. Does that include, the ability, we've talked a lot about passing the farm down to the next generation. Is that what we're talking about here as well with some of those tax policies?
That's exactly right. In 2025, unless Congress acts, the estate tax exemption gets cut in half automatically without, any action from Congress or the president. It gets reduced by a half. Obviously, that has a lot of implications. There was a lot of talk during the campaign of getting rid of the stepped up basis. My own view is that's probably could have the biggest negative impact on family farms out there if you started taxing without the use of stepped up basis. There's no chance of that happening now, given the outcome of the election. So overall, I feel pretty optimistic on our tax policy going forward. And, farmers are going to have, a good opportunity to make some money and keep it. And that's always important.
And John, I'll give you the same opportunity here with the Nature Conservancy.
Well, I appreciate that. And I will echo Chuck's sentiment. Thank you for the opportunity to be a part of this today. I've enjoyed it. It's something that I used to do on the regular, and it's nice to be able to step back into that. So thank you both for that opportunity. The Nature Conservancy is really the state's largest environmental conservation group, if you will. We have 60 people across the state. We have 7 offices in various areas. And a big majority of our work is done in rural Indiana and done with agriculture interests. We work with farmers to bring conservation ag everywhere from the Upper White River to try to improve outcomes on the White River to the Wabash River to all across the state. The 4R program is something that was developed at the Nature Conservancy through the Nature Conservancy with agricultural interests. We try to promote conservation farming practices, and we work very closely with folks to do that. We were recently the recipient of an RCPP grant from the USDA of about $15.5 million to bring improvements to the middle of the section of the Wabash River in Indiana and up around the Lafayette area, which is, a heavily agriculture area and an area that we work very closely with the folks up there for. So ag is important to conservation. As Senator Young mentioned to me years ago, you can't have conservation without conservative. And he's right about that. I think folks who understand and can see the benefits realize those benefits, and we are here to help promote that and make improvement for all folks who are involved. So thanks again for the opportunity, Eric and Steve, and hope we can do it again someday.
Absolutely. We'd love to have you back here on the Indiana Ag Policy Podcast. And Chuck, John, Steve, thanks for joining us.
Good to be here.
Really appreciate it, and we'll get together again soon, and hopefully have some more answers. Maybe a farm bill at some point.
I am leaving Chuck, here more optimistic. Thank you for that, Chuck.
Chuck well, is glass
half
full.
We can only hope, you guys. We can only hope.
Well, whether it's that or it's trade or it's biofuels or infrastructure, that's why farmers need to be members of Indiana Corn Growers and Indiana Soybean Alliance and other associations. We work alongside of Chuck's organization, John's organization. There's a lot of work that needs to be done. It doesn't happen without membership. So
absolutely.
We need to have you.
Absolutely.
They've got to make their voice heard. They really do.
Amen. Thanks for joining us for another edition of the Indiana Ag Policy Podcast, presented by the Indiana Corn Growers Association, the Indiana Soybean Alliance, Indiana Farm Bureau, and Beck's Hybrids.